Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 75 of the Go Get Outside podcast. This is your host, Jason Milligan. Welcome back. Welcome aboard. That's right. This is episode 75. It is the last episode of 2018. And we've got a good one for you today. We have Rich Rideau. He is a board member of the Coalition of American Canyoneers and is largely recognized for his explorations and help in developing many of the technical canyons in the Grand Canyon. If any of you listening have ever used Todd Martin's Grand Canyoneering book to get beta on the many canyons in the Grand Canyon, well, Rich is one of the people you can thank for helping make that happen. He has been exploring above and beneath the rim of the Grand Canyon for nearly three decades and has become recognized by many sources as an expert in the area, having appeared in magazines such as National Geographic, Backpacker, Outside, and also in films by artists such as Dan Ransom and Pete McBride. Luckily, we were able to cross paths earlier this year in July when he was out in the North Rim area photographing lightning and other monsoon activity in the canyon. We met one rainy day in Kanab and recorded this podcast, so forewarning, this episode does begin with a lot of rain noise, but within the first 6 or 7 minutes, it pretty much clears up and disappears. So bear with us through the sounds of the rain, and let's go talk about canyoneering, pack rafting, photography, exploration, lightning, and personal responsibility.
My name is Rich Rideau. I guess I'm best known in the outdoor community or world for doing lots and lots of different things in Grand Canyon, which has, you know, always been a passion of mine. I thought about this recently, and I've spent 27 or 28 years of my life playing in Grand Canyon in one form or another. You know, do other things in other places, but, you know, it's a 10% kind of activity. There's always something more to do in Grand Canyon, something more that's interesting about Grand Canyon. And so it's always been just my go-to place to learn, explore, and just see nature in its, you know, kind of rawest, most kind of momentous form.
I'm sure we're going to get into a whole bunch of things, like the fact that you may be the first guest, I'm not positive about this, but the first guest on this show ever who has been in National Geographic, because they followed you around. Right when you went beneath the rim to walk the entire length of the Grand Canyon?
That was really a story that Pete McBride and Kevin Fedarko were doing about threats to the Grand Canyon. Pete had contacted me. We had met at a film festival 3 or 4 years earlier, but I really didn't know Pete well at all. But ultimately, Pete had this idea to walk the length of the canyon. A mutual friend of ours said, well, do you know Rich Rideau? Because he's about to leave this fall on a two-month journey beneath the rim to walk the entire Grand Canyon. And so we were introduced, and Pete's original idea was to record the threats to Grand Canyon over three different seasons. You know, Pete's a National Geographic photographer, and Kevin is a, you know, New York Times bestseller author. And so, you know, Pete had this vision on this project that would tell a story about how Grand Canyon was under threat. And he was really looking for me to provide a little bit of help. I wasn't really part of the story. I was more a resource for him to understand how he can get through that three-dimensional labyrinth over 700 or 800 miles. And as, you know, we worked together on that project, the original idea was Pete and Kevin would join us for 12 days on the first leg of our trip and then leave, and we would continue through the canyon for, you know, the next 45 or 46 days or so to do this continuous hike. Pete's idea was never to do a continuous hike. He wanted to get photographs in different seasons. It's kind of a constant reminder when you play in Grand Canyon. Sometimes you become numb to the challenges of moving about the place, and you forget how difficult it is and how your body's become tuned to moving throughout this off-trail terrain, and you don't think a lot about it. But people that don't hike in Grand Canyon just don't have that experience. They don't know what they don't know.
At some point, you were probably fearful of the same thing, but then you got so accustomed to it, you forgot it as a thing you could fear at all.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so in this trip, despite the fact I met with Pete and Kevin a few months ahead of time, we talked about logistics, we talked about food, calorie content, how many calories you had to eat a day, how that equated to food weight, you know, how many calories an ounce you needed to keep your pack size under control, where to place food caches, you know, the incredible logistics of a hike like that, you know, it's completely self-supported. It's not like walking through the Appalachian Trail where, you know, you can pop into a town every couple of days and resupply.
And this is all beneath the rim, right?
It's all beneath the rim.
Right, so it's not like there are towns down there.
No, none. You're completely 100% self-supported. And so, you know, you have to cache your food ahead of time at points throughout the canyon. So as I, you know, went through the logistics with Pete and Kevin, they were both incredibly busy on other projects. And I think even though they both had been in Grand Canyon and done things in Grand Canyon, I think the pressure of these existing projects, and I think just the assumptions about how their other backcountry experiences would translate into Grand Canyon, caused them both to be a little bit complacent. And after the first day, it became abundantly clear to them that this was really hard. And they were both, you know, nursing various wounds from cactus spines to, you know, severe blisters.
And correct me if I'm wrong, this is after Pete had done his film where he followed the Colorado River to the ocean, right? Or attempted to and discovered that you no longer could.
Yeah, that's right.
So he may have had some notions of what it was like to be in the Grand Canyon, but he was on the river before.
Yeah, when he did that Source to Sea trip to explore the Colorado River, you know, the idea was to kind of document what was happening from the river, not to walk the whole thing. So Pete's father is an airplane pilot. They flew part of it. He's got just remarkable photographs from that experience and kind of the opportunity to bond with his dad about a topic he was really passionate about. I think he went through Grand Canyon on a river trip at that point in time. They pack rafted some stretches. They walked some stretches. They learned ultimately that they had to walk the last 90 miles or something.
Right, right.
To actually get to the ocean. So Pete's experience really wasn't walking through the canyon, even though he had been through the canyon. Mm-hmm. You realize when you're starting to walk through the canyon doing these trans-canyon routes that, with just a few exceptions, there are almost no trails, especially on the north side of the river where we were. And so every step requires focus. The terrain is frequently class 3, often class 4, and occasionally class 5. You've got to be comfortable in doing this kind of terrain and traverses on that terrain.
With gear.
With gear
on your back.
With a full pack. And so after the first day, they all of a sudden realized that this was really hard. And all of these incredible experiences they had had around the world covering various topics didn't really prepare them for walking through Grand Canyon. So we made it about 6 days with Pete and Kevin. It caused Dave and Chris and I, who were doing the full Trans Canyon through hike, to be a little bit behind schedule. Pete was started to have a real serious emergency condition called hypernatremia, where you sweat so much, you're sweating a lot of salts out of your body and potassium. And so if you have low salts and potassium, they've been diluted out of your body, you can start to have a lot of cramping and potentially seizures. Your heart doesn't get the nutrients required to keep beating. He got to be really serious, and we just ran out of electrolytes to feed him. It was hotter than we expected. You know, when you plan this hike, we spent a year planning it. You go when your permit says you can go, and you deal with whatever weather comes at you. And we happen to have a hot streak for the first, you know, week or week and a half.
I think some of the people don't realize also is that when they're on the rim of the Grand Canyon and they're thinking it's hot, it's actually hotter at the bottom.
Yeah, the river in Grand Canyon is roughly the same temperature as Phoenix or Las Vegas. You're walking in that real hot, arid desert environment. But when you're on the rim, you know, you're at 7,000 or 8,000 feet, depending on which rim. And you have these mild alpine temperate conditions there even in the summer, including the thunderstorms like we're hearing right now in the background.
Yeah. For those that don't know what's going on, we're sitting in a park. Immediately we decided we needed to start recording. A storm rolled in, and so you will be hearing lightning and thunder and rain throughout this, I'm sure.
Which is ironically the same weather you have over Grand Canyon right now.
Right.
Pete and Kevin had to leave about halfway through their planned trip on the first leg and both go back and rehabilitate a bit. Pete had to have a minor surgery to remove a spine and an ankle. Kevin's feet were, you know, hamburger for 2 or 3 weeks. And then Pete had to be treated for hypernatremia, which involved getting his body replenished with the right electrolytes. In the meantime, I sent a text out. I had a satellite text unit on this through hike, so I communicate with the outside world. And so we called on a few friends of ours to see if they couldn't help these guys out in their trek across the canyon through the length of the canyon to help document the threats to Grand Canyon. And it turned out that a few friends were available and able to help them and came back and helped them on the next leg and then helped them again. And then I ultimately finished my through hike in November of 2015 and was able to circle back and hike with Pete and Kevin several more times. So I probably spent a little more than a month beneath the rim with those two guys as they were doing their hike through various seasons.
And so we kind of jumped jumped right into the National Geographic story. But the whole reason you were contacted about that is because you have so much experience in the Grand Canyon. So let's go back, way back, to how that experience began. So let's talk about little bitty Rich Rudeau. Where'd he grow up?
Yeah.
In the Grand Canyon?
No, I grew up in Northern California in a small rice farming community north of Sacramento, and went to college and got an electrical engineering degree and worked in Los Angeles for 3 years. My wife and I at the time, neither of us liked Los Angeles, so I was in the defense industry at that time. Her family was from Phoenix. We moved to Phoenix, and I continued working in the defense industry for, another 5 or 6 years. Always had kind of a independent spirit and entrepreneurial mindset, and decided early on that the defense industry was too slow for me and never make any real money doing that anyway. And so I started a startup company that was venture funded and ran that company 4 years, and we spun off another company that I ran after that, all focused on GPS technology and how it was applied to business applications. And that company was sold to a company called Trimble, which is a manufacturer of GPS equipment. And I worked at Trimble a long time. And, you know, as an entrepreneur, my life is a little bit backwards from the typical person you meet. People will often go to college and take a year off and find themselves and get engaged with this great love that some people have of the outdoors. And I didn't do that. I got out of high school when I was, 17, graduated from college when I was 20, had 4 job offers, went right into industry, and just worked my tail off for a long time. When I sold my last company, I was 37, had agreed to stay with Trimble for 3 years, and Trimble turned out to be a great company and a great experience. I ran a variety of businesses there, stayed 13 years. When I turned 50, I decided that's it, I'm going to retire. During that time, I was probably in my late 30s before I spent a lot of time in Grand Canyon. My first introduction to Grand Canyon was in 1989. My wife bought me a river trip as a gift, and she had no idea what, how that would complicate her life at the time. But, as I floated through Grand Canyon on this motorboat with 20 other people on board, we'd stop at these side canyons and we would hike up these side canyons. And it was incredibly impactful on me because we would see these delicate microenvironments with these colors and these textures and water and places I'd never seen before in the outdoors. And you could only go so far. And I would constantly ask the guy that was driving the boat, so what's up there? Well, I don't know. Nobody's ever been up there. We don't go up there, And Yeah, well, I mean, I think he just got kind of ultimately frustrated with this guy that just keeps asking questions like a 3-year-old. Dad, what's that? And so, after that trip, I started reading about some people that had been exploring in Grand Canyon, and you ultimately stumble across this fellow named Harvey Butchert. That
I knew his name was going to have to come up at some point.
Yeah, Harvey, from the late 40s up until about 1981 or 82, when he couldn't hike in Grand Canyon anymore, really started exploring the place. A lot of the historical knowledge of the canyon, the prospectors, the Native Americans that were there first, it kind of dissipated. And so there was this blank. People didn't know what these places were, even though the Native Americans were all over Grand Canyon at some point. And so Harvey took these notes about how to traverse through the place. And so I just was enthralled with reading about how you move through this incredibly complex and big and bold landscape with all of these intricate little places. And I'd read Harvey's notes and, think about doing trips. And of course, my brother-in-law and I started hiking in Grand Canyon after that river trip. We just started doing the trails that everybody else does. That's all we knew. By the mid-90s, we were interested in actually doing some of that stuff Harvey had done.
How interested were you in riding the length of the Colorado River, hugging an inflatable sleeping pad?
Yeah. Harvey was known for taking big, bold risks like that. A lot of people that have heard of me through some of the exploration stuff we've done in Grand Canyon, I think have this misconception that my friend Todd Martin and I are these big risk takers, going out and descending these canyons. And it just couldn't be furthest from the truth. There's very little risk taking that's going on. Neither one of us are willing to take risks that are unnecessary. And, in my case, it was a long time of just very slowly and progressively learning about Grand Canyon, learning how to hike in Grand Canyon, hiking the trails, and then coming back and my brother-in-law Dale and I looking at Harvey's notes, well, let's go try that. That doesn't look too, or doesn't sound too difficult. And as you try these routes, you start to get a sense of Harvey's very terse prose. He can describe a route in 2 sentences, but every word matters. Every single word matters, right? And so then you quickly learn, I didn't realize how important the word sporty was. He had this lexicon. Progressively, Dale and I would, you know, want to do these routes, and sometimes there was, you know, we should bring a hand line. You know, we might have to lower our packs in that spot, use a hand line. And then pretty quick it was, you know, if we had a rope and knew how to rappel, we could go to this one place. We want to go see that place. And at some point, my wife got really nervous, and her brother and I are out screwing around in Grand Canyon doing these things that she doesn't, you know, fully appreciate.
She's still thinking, damn it, why did I buy him that stupid river trip?
Yeah, no kidding. She thinks that to this day. We've been married 31 years, and she constantly reminds me of that. At some point, she got nervous enough that she was like, well, you and my brother don't know what you're doing. You've never had any classes in rappelling. What are you doing? You know, so she bought us both rock climbing classes. And of course, all that did was embolden us. It's like, Oh, that's a good knot to tie for that problem. You know, we can actually make an anchor, and we can take more gear. And, you know, ultimately we just started doing harder hikes. And the goal was never to use gear or, you know, have these technical experiences. The goal is to see this remarkable beauty just hidden deeply in the fabric of this place. So, and then ultimately, you know, Dale got hurt in a car accident, and he could not hike in Grand Canyon in the off-trail areas anymore. He's got reconstructed matrix of metal plates in one of his legs, and his ankle isn't stable anymore. I was really getting intrigued by some of the canyons that we had been around and had seen but hadn't been down. And at that time, Todd Martin was interested in this canyon called Buck Farm. I had been up Buck Farm from the river, and I had been up and down this route on the south side, really the east side of Marble Canyon, called the Eminence Break Route. So Todd was interested in the slot, but I knew how to get out. You know, I knew how to get out of the place. And so Todd and I kind of teamed up to go do that trip. We had done a few canyons together in the Phoenix area before that, and it turned out to be every bit of the adventure we both were looking for. I had this crazy idea in that trip. We had to cross the Colorado River, and I had been on the river in a river trip, and I had some familiarity with this particular place in the river, and it was pretty calm. And so I told Todd, I said, look, we got to get across the river, but we can do it with a pack raft. And he's like, what? I said, yeah. And no, we can't all carry a pack raft. We just can't afford the weight with all the ropes and technical gear you've got to carry. So, but I've got an idea. We'll carry one pack raft for all four guys.
Is this going to turn into the problem where it's like you have a fox and a chicken each on either side of the river, and you need one boat, and you need to get them across? Is that what this turns into?
Yeah, well, it kind of does, right? So I went to, I think, Cabela's at that time, and I bought this deep sea fishing reel, and I also bought a fishing pole, and I bought this 135-pound test Kevlar fishing line. It was really thin, but really strong. A friend of mine had mentioned trying to cross in a raft in Grand Canyon one time and then have a buddy pull the raft back with a rope. It didn't work because the drag on the rope was so strong in the water it was uncontrollable. And so the whole technique fell apart. And I thought, well, you know, being an engineer, we can improve on that. We'll use this super thin Kevlar line. And I cut the fishing pole off, so it was just a little stub, and put the reel on the pole and rigged this thing up and convinced Todd. And
was it easy to convince him, or did it take a lot of convincing?
No, I mean, Todd is game for anything if it's a well thought out plan.
Even
right?
If it potentially means he's going to have to swim across the Colorado River at some point.
I don't think we were that fearful of that. I mean, you know, as canyoneers, you carry wetsuits anyway because, you know, canyons are often wet and cold. So, you know, we felt like we had thermal protection. And the biggest risk in the Colorado where we wanted to cross anyway was, you know, the water's 48 degrees and you can become hypothermic and then your muscles stop working. You've got a couple minutes in that water before you're not functional anymore. It's very dangerous swimming in the river. But with a wetsuit on, extends your safety margin dramatically. And we knew that where we were going to cross was calm. And of course, we also knew that President Harding Rapid was about a third of a mile downstream. So
don't screw up.
Don't screw up. Yeah. So as this adventure goes, we descended this canyon. It was tremendously beautiful. The slot canyons in Grand Canyon that are most interesting tend to be the ones in the limestone layers because they're sculpted in unique ways. They're narrow. They've got potholes. They've got these colors and textures that are really, really beautiful. And so we were all blown away by the canyon. We got to the river and blew up the pack raft. First friend went across and everything went great, and I reeled the boat back with this deep sea fishing reel, and I had this big smile on my face, like, "Yeah, I feel like the master of the universe. This is awesome. What could go wrong?" Todd paddles across, and it's great, and I reel the boat back across, and the next guy starts like paddling out, and this is a real cheap pack raft. It's a Sevler trail boat, and it comes with this little tiny paddle, and there's this little plastic fitting that you could connect together into this little mini kayak paddle setup. The last guy had never paddled a boat before. I'm assuming today, because you know, he was flailing about, twisting around, and started getting tangled in the line. And about halfway across the river, he broke the paddle. This fishing reel had a counter on it, and it would tell you how much line had spooled out. And I put 700 feet of line on this reel, knowing that the Colorado River averages about 300 feet wide. Figured that's a lot of margin. You know, you can drift way downstream, and I can still, you know, reel that thing back. So this guy breaks the paddle, and he's tangled up in the line, and he's completely out of control. I'm yelling to friends on the other bank, 400 feet, 500 feet, as the raft and this guy are just drifting out of control downstream.
And can you see him at this point?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Oh, yeah. I can see everybody, right? I can see Todd and Aaron on the far side of the river, and I can see our friend Scott that is having this trouble in the river, and holy crap, this is not going good. You know, 500 feet, and I'm thinking, what's going to happen when he hits the end of the line? Either line's going to break, there's so much force in the river, and then I'm stuck on the wrong side of the fence with no way to get across, or, you know, who knows? You know, and what's going to happen to this guy that's in a raft?
Right.
With no paddle.
And are there other exit options for him if he floats down a certain degree?
Well, not really, because he's going to hit present Harding Rapid, which is almost certainly a flip event, especially without a paddle, right?
Right.
So he's going to be swimming no matter what, and the boat's going to be gone. He kind of hand paddles and gets closer and closer to the shore, and Aaron managed to jump in the river, swim out, you know, wetsuit on, grab him, and they kind of collectively got him back to the shore. And there had to be, I don't know, almost 600 feet of line that had paid out at that point. You know, they're way downstream of where I am. And I reeled the boat back. When I get the boat, all I have are these two little, the paddle's broken in half, right? So I have these two little right. stubs of a handle on this paddle. It's like, well, crap, what am I going to do? Well, I'm just going to paddle this thing like I would if I had two spatulas in my hand. And I did. And it worked so well that...
That's your preferred technique now?
You know, it was for a long time. This is like an incremental learning process. There's so many people that, you know, they get inspired by reading Todd's book, which is just an amazing book on these remarkable places that a lot of people haven't been able to see in Grand Canyon. And you get inspired to go do that. But I think people, they lose the first 100 pages of Todd's book where he talks about all the things you should know and all of the cautions and safety things and stuff. And right, and so we, you know, we learned this stuff over a really long period of time, a very slow, progressive, incremental improvement, what we're doing. You know, in that trip, I paddled back across with these two little broken paddle with two little blades in each hand, and it worked fine. And I was really surprised by that, but it worked great. And so we resolved that there were two problems with the fishing line idea, and it was never used again. You know, the first problem was the one we observed firsthand, which is it's easy for somebody to get tangled up in the line.
Right.
And then the other one we thought of later is, you know, what if a raft came floating by and we clotheslined somebody?
Yeah. I had that thought as well.
We resolved that there had to be a better way to go do this. And if everybody could carry a raft, it'd be every man for himself. You know, it'd be so much fun to be able to go downriver a short ways or cross the river. The boats and stuff were heavy. And we did trips after that where everybody carried a Sevler trail boat, but they were really heavy. I mean, in the context of, you think about what it takes to carry a pack through Grand Canyon with no trails, all of this really difficult terrain, low class 5 climbing in places, you know, and a pack with heavy ropes and gear.
And these are also all exploratory descents, right? So you're not positive what's in there, so you're carrying extra just in case.
Yeah. I think, you know, Todd and I found ourselves in this rare point in modern time where people hadn't been in this one little piece of Grand Canyon. You know, Harvey had walked all over the place, but, you know, he walked around all the slots. And so it's most of the other climbers and hikers. People did not want to go in those places. There was a high level of anxiety and awareness that you don't know how many rappels there are and how long the rope's got to be. And if you get trapped there, you're done. And so people just avoided Grand Canyon. And of course, to Todd and I, the more canyons we did, the more we were invigorated because we started to discover that so many of them were remarkably beautiful, unique in different ways. And we started to collectively figure out what the exploratory gear set looked like. We were always going through canyons. We always carried an emergency bolt kit. You know, I've placed a couple thousand anchors in Grand Canyon over the years and probably placed 15 bolts ever. And most of the time, those were placed because we were in deep doo-doo somehow. We got a 300-foot rappel and a 250-foot rope. What do you do? You know, mid-wall placement. Most of the time, it came down to either we ended up with our go-to exploratory kit being inadequate in some way and a bolt had to be placed, or we ended up in a scenario where there was no way to affect a good pull in a canyon. Bolt was necessary to kind of get the anchor where we needed it to be able to retrieve the gear. You know, I think most of the technical descents that Todd and I did were, many of them were first descents. There were some that had been done. There are some common canyons in Grand Canyon that have been done by some real pioneers. You know, some people like Glenn Rink and his friends did Chinuma Wash, which is also called 29 Mile Canyon, which is an amazing red wall slot. Glenn and some of his friends did the first descent of Tatahatso and Sinyella and, you know, some amazing canyons. But for the most part, their goal, you know, they were climbers and really good climbers, and they were river runners, and their goal was just to explore around. Canyons weren't really a passion. And Todd and I realized all of a sudden that there were so many amazing places that hadn't been seen, and both of us are into photography. And so we would take cameras we thought could survive slot canyons, take lots of pictures and stuff. So it was kind of an invigorating time to be in Grand Canyon. We were just lucky to kind of have a passion for the place and a passion to, you know, see more of it before other people had the idea or the passion to go do it themselves.
Something I think that's kind of cool. So I have read Grand Obsession, which is that Harvey Bichart book that you can buy at every shop in the Grand Canyon. Your story and Todd's story are kind of a continuation of his. It's he came to the area. He accidentally discovers the Grand Canyon. It becomes an obsession. He wants to walk as much of it as possible. You come along, accidentally discover the Grand Canyon, and then you want to walk what he's walked and then see what he hasn't seen. Yeah. And so you guys have then taken it further, where going places where you can only get with technical gear, which was a little beyond his goal at that point. And it sounded like earlier you were headed in the direction of proper pack rafts. It sounds like became an important thing for you guys.
What became important was building systems that could allow effective and safe slot canyon exploration in Grand Canyon. It really meant that you needed lightweight packs, but they had to be durable, and you needed the right canyoning gear. You could not bring the kitchen sink of canyoning gear and get through the place. You just can't carry it all. And so we quickly decided, after doing some canyons and gaining some experience and having a few oh shit moments where ropes weren't long enough or whatever, that the very minimalist exploration kit in Grand Canyon was a 250-foot rope, 100-foot working rope, 200-foot pull cord, an emergency bolt kit, and the lightest pack raft you could find. You know, a set of these, we called them spatula paddles, because it was a lot lighter not to have a handle. You just grip the paddle and paddle across, or use hand gloves. We kind of developed this system for traveling in the backcountry Grand Canyon, carrying a bunch of gear, descending canyons, exiting those canyons on the river to places where you could climb back to the rim again. And it was a very evolutionary kind of process. You know, we constantly looked to make things better and lighter. One of our friends who was on that first Buck Farm trip, Aaron Locander, decided, he's also an engineer at Intel, and Aaron decided that he could make a better pack raft. And he spent about 4 years with materials and processes to glue materials together in developing a lightweight pack raft. And I remember early trips where, you know, Steve Ramris Ram and Tom Jones and Sonny Lawrence and Todd and I and Aaron, we'd all go out and check things out. We'd have a potpourri of pack rafts. You know, we're kind of testing little things here and there to see what was going to go work. Anyway, Aaron ultimately developed a pack raft that was less than half the weight of the Sevler trail boat. And Sevler ended up discontinuing that boat, so we were left high and dry with nothing. And the raft Aaron ultimately developed is now a commercial company called Supai Adventure Gear. And these pack rafts weigh 23 or 24 ounces.
They sincerely collapse down to the size of a Nalgene bottle.
Yeah.
They sincerely do.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you need something really light and weight for the pack raft, the paddle, the PFD. They need to be very small and compact. You know, in the end, the pack raft is just kind of an incidental part of the kit in order to do these amazingly beautiful routes in Grand Canyon.
So there are people listening, because a number of canyoneers do listen to this show, and there are people listening right now and they're saying, but Rich, why don't you use everyone's favorite super cheap Explorer 200 raft?
Yeah. Well, I think the answer is simple. I mean, if, you know, if I were doing like one trip in Grand Canyon or something, I might suffer the physical abuse of hauling a 5-pound piece of plastic around.
It feels like it's 30 pounds, and it's so huge, and it collapses down to the size of a small human.
It's interesting. I've heard of a lot of people using those Explorer rafts, and I think they work fine. I mean, I don't think I've heard of one like blowing up on the river or anything. I think they're fine. What you realize is, if you want to go see the prettiest, most stunning slot canyons in Grand Canyon, they tend to be in the remote areas. And the thing I loved about exploring canyons in Grand Canyon is it involved these incredible routes. You know, you would come off the rim on this technical terrain to get down different layers to just access the slot canyon. And you traverse in some cases on certain layers where traversing was more, you know, amenable to human human travel. And then you'd rappel through these canyons, and you'd see these amazing things in these slot canyons. And when you get to the river, you'd float down the Colorado River in nothing more than a pool toy, and get to a place where you could actually climb back to the rim again. And we, Todd and I, constructed these stunningly beautiful routes that nobody had ever done before. I was always more excited about the route that we built to see this incredible part of the backcountry. And the route sometimes would chain together multiple slots. You know, you pack off the ways, climb back up, come down a different one, and you start to realize that it's almost infinite. It's like a mathematical problem. You can construct an infinite number of truly beautiful routes where you're never traversing the same terrain and getting, starting at your car and getting back to your car, that involves the use of technical gear to get through canyons, lightweight hiking gear to, carry everything and traverse, gear to float the river for short distances, and then climbing to get back out. Really invigorated by, the whole idea of being able to piece together new ways of traveling through this ancient terrain.
So there are canyons and there are places to explore all over the world, right? And there are all kinds of different environments you could go to, but something specifically draws you to the Grand Canyon, so much so that now you're one of those people that's considered an expert of what's below that rim. What about the Grand Canyon itself draws you again and again into it instead of going to explore somewhere that you've never been before?
Yeah, I think it's a mixture of things. One, the place is unfathomably big. I mean, the human mind doesn't really make this connection to how big Grand Canyon is, and you can't stand on the rim and see it all. In fact, you can't stand on the rim and see even 10%, right? And so I think the main reason was I would go to Grand Canyon. It's the South Rim is 4 hours from my home in the Phoenix area. And I could get into some incredibly remote, stunningly beautiful terrain where Todd and I would do these trips and we'd never see other people. I mean, it was very, very rare. And if we ran into other people, sometimes it was a river trip floating by or something. But you can get metaphorically lost in the last great wilderness in the continental U.S. Every time I went there, I would come up with two more projects. It was like, oh my God, I can't believe this thing we walked by. I want to go back and look at that. It just became, for me, this thing that I could go visit close to home and see something new every single time. This year is kind of an interesting milestone for me. I'm on track right now to hit my 1,000th day below the rim of Grand Canyon. I've never taken a trip in Grand Canyon where it was like, oh, ho-hum, boring, didn't learn something new, didn't see something new. And I think a lot of it is just, it's that big. And there's always something new and interesting to go see. And I've kind of evolved. I learned about Grand Canyon first on the river and learned that on that short 7-day river trip, I found this amazing place that I had to know more about. And then we learned more when Dale and I would hike and learn more when we wanted to go do Harvey's routes and, learn more when Todd and I wanted to go explore these slot canyons. Todd was always, and still is, he's fascinated by the slot canyons. He loves that part of Grand Canyon, but he really dislikes hiking in Grand Canyon. So
That's bad news for him.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, Todd just, he's a phenomenally fit, capable hiker. I mean, we both did all of this really hard terrain, thousands of miles running around Grand Canyon, entering and exiting slots. But the entire route wasn't enjoyable to Todd, right? The most enjoyable part of the route to Todd was always the canyons and the beauty in those canyons and photographing those canyons. I had that same enthusiasm about the canyons, but I love the route. I love like standing on the rim, looking at like, well, how are we going to get down that? Hey, let's go try this, bust this move over here and see if we can get off there. And I read in Harvey's notes, these two sentences said that we ought to be able to, get out over there. Can we piece that together? So, and then the pack rafting part in the river. I think Todd and I both enjoyed the pack rafting part in the river. But I kind of always felt that these slot canyon adventures were, it was a grand adventure in that we weren't just exploring canyons. For me, I was exploring all of these threads in the canyon, these routes in the canyon. And every time we took a route, we would either find a new canyon we wanted to explore later, or I'd find a way to tie places together that I wanted to see collectively by traversing some of these routes that we learned about through exploring canyons. It was this experience for me where the more I explored the canyon, the bigger my to-do list got, And the bigger the to-do list got, the more I wanted, the more time I wanted to spend there seeing these places. And I started running the river. I'd never actually rode through the canyon myself. You know, I've done that now. I'm launching on my 11th river trip in late October this year and my 12th one in January next year. I learned about all of these ways to experience this place. And I don't feel like I've seen it all.
It's that whole onion thing, right? You peel off a layer and then you find that there are infinite layers beneath it.
Yeah. It's you stand at the rim and you look at the place and it's got this kind of, it's a three-dimensional landscape. Your initial impression, if you're not accustomed to Grand Canyon, is, that's one mighty big hole in the ground. Awesome. Let's go check out Antelope Canyon on our, way right. by, or, do something else. I've experienced Grand Canyon. The more you get into the fabric of Grand Canyon, the more you realize that it is amazingly complex. It is amazingly beautiful in each rock layer. It's got these attributes in its geology that tells you something about where you are. You know, if you hike in Grand Canyon a lot, people have asked me when I through hiked Grand Canyon, 57-day period below the rim, how many miles did you go? It's like, we people that hike in Grand Canyon a lot don't ever talk about progress in terms of miles because it's not very relevant. You talk about progress on a route in terms of hours. How many hours does it take to go from point A to point B? Because mileage is incredibly difficult to figure out. It's three-dimensional, first of all. You might go up 2,000 or 3,000 feet and right. back down and back up again. And every step you take is a concentrated effort. You're either trying to step to avoid a rock that can, bust loose, or you're stepping to avoid cactus that can stab you right in the calf. There are no long stretches of linear steps like you're walking through a park. It just doesn't exist that way.
Yeah, my experience with the Grand Canyon, so the first time I ever saw it was 99, and I was on a trip making my way to Vegas for the 2000 new year, almost out of college. I had told you earlier, I grew up in Louisiana. I'd never seen the Grand Canyon in reality, and I was just curious to see what it was. We knew we'd be passing through that area, so we went and took a look. And I expected it to just be a big hole in the ground, right? Just, it's just going to be a huge hole. And then I was amazed that it was just from the rim, such an intricate network of ecosystems and things that I could just see from above. And then it was probably 10 years before I went back. And that time we actually hiked down, stayed in the campground by Phantom Ranch and hiked back out. And what I was amazed at that time, hiking that mile down, vertically into the canyon, you go through so many different sorts of environments. One moment you feel like you're in the desert, and another moment you're in some riparian green area with flowing water. It's like right. you've done 10 different hikes in that one day.
Yeah, there are probably more life zones in Grand Canyon than any other place, and it's because of this big vertical displacement. Your experience is right on. And that was something that I discovered as Dale and I would hike about the place, and got really reinforced and rediscovered when Todd and I were exploring canyons. And, more recently, I still do canyons. We still explore canyons. We've done a couple of new ones in the last 6 months, but not at the pace that Todd and I once did. First of all, the canyons that are left, we think might be really beautiful, are few and far between, or they're canyons where you carry a 600-foot rope, or, they're really, really big, big exits. And so, we do some of those occasionally. We did one earlier this year that my friend Guy Smith and Keith Peterson and I scouted it a couple of years ago, and Guy and I were in 5 or 6 rappels and decided we better jug out. This looks big and ugly when we hit a big drop. We weren't equipped quite at the level we want to be equipped. So we jugged out and came back a couple of years later. Todd joined us on that trip, and our friend David Wallace, and we finished that canyon, and it was, it was terrific. It was really amazing. There's still new canyons to do, but they're obscure. They're tributaries of tributaries of tributaries in some cases. They're remarkably hard to get to. In many cases, they're probably best left unpublished, just too hard for most people to mess with. Half the challenge is getting to the rim, 100 miles of dirt roads that aren't improved at all to even begin your journey, right? And then the challenges below the rim are really hard in the more remote areas. So
your interests have developed in other ways in the Grand Canyon. For instance, why you're here now is you've been out on the plateau shooting photographs of lightning. Do you want to tell us about that and why you got interested in doing that?
Yeah, well, I've always had this interest in photography, but I really didn't have any skills. Todd always hiked with a better camera that was in a waterproof housing. And I'd always hike with the kind of standard Canyoneer issue point and shoot waterproof camera. I was surprised. We both got really good photos from time to time there. And I really enjoyed kind of taking photos of these places. Todd and I both did. When I decided that I wanted to walk the length of the canyon, it was something that had been done very few times. I think Pete McBride came up with a saying that more people had walked on the moon than had walked the length of the canyon when my friend Chris Atwood and I walked the length of the canyon, and it was true. I really wanted to be able to take better pictures on this trip. It was one of those things where, I had retired, which afforded me the time to actually do some, big audacious goal like that. I knew how hard it was. Todd and I would go out and explore canyons for a week, and we'd both come back just beat to hell, right? And we'd need a week to recover. There was no illusion of how difficult it was moving about that terrain. And the biggest thing to me was, will my body hold up for 2 solid months below the rim? Am I physically able to do this, right? Day after day after day of beating the hell out of yourself, moving through this complex three-dimensional maze. I didn't know the answer to that question, but I did know that I want to document it. I want to take better photos than I've been able to take before. So, of course, I called Dan Ransom, who's with me now on this little jaunt.
He refused to come along with us so that he could harass you the entire time during this show.
Dan's like that. He only harasses me off the air. Anyway, I called Dan and said, Dan, I need a good camera to take pictures. Oh, I forgot to tell you, it's got to be super light. It's got to be stupid light. And he's like, okay, well, that pretty much narrows it down. There are only 2 cameras that are going to work. And you just have to decide if you want to be able to interchange the lenses or not. It's like, well, I would probably like to interchange the lenses at some point, but I'm sure the hell not carry multiple lenses in this trip. He said, well, just go buy a Sony A6000. That's the camera you need. So I did. And as I did this hike through the Grand Canyon, I ended up taking almost 7,000 photos. And we had the worst weather at times imaginable, where lightning, thunder, high winds, flash floods. We had 13 flash floods on this trip. We just happened to hit a period that started out really hot and dry and then turned into a wet, wet morass for 5 weeks straight. When I got done with that trip, there was this huge sense of accomplishment that we had actually been able to do it. I was kind of amazed that 50 years old at that time, that my body held up to that kind of stress and rigor day after day after day. When I looked back at those photos, I was just amazed at how some of them turned out. Of those 7,000 photos, I don't know how many are actually really good. If Dan were here now, he would point out that my entire photography technique at that time consisted of spray and pray. Yeah. So hence 7,000 photos to get those 2 good ones. It kind of vividly brought out these remarkable sections of the canyon that few people ever get to see in these settings. Kind of brings me back when I look at those photos to what I was feeling on that day when I took that photo and what was going on. And I got back from that trip and it's like, this photography stuff is really, really interesting. I'd love to be better at it, right? It's great to be hanging out with people that are pros. I mean, Dan or Pete McBride or Jim Harris or my friend Bill Church. I mean, these guys are really, really good photographers. And so every time we go out, I would like say, well, Pete, what are you doing over there? I mean, I don't see that shot. And I go over and I look on his viewfinder and it's like, oh, unbelievable. Look at that. And so I've been very fortunate to learn about this from some guys that have forgotten more about photography than I'll ever know. It's inspiring to see Grand Canyon in all of these different moods. Even if I go back to a place I've been to, it's really interesting to see if it's changed and how it's changed, and the best way to do that is to kind of look at photos. In my mid-30s, we'd go hike in the inner canyon in the summer. And, as I've gotten older, it's harder to do those routes that I want to go do in the really remote areas. And it's really not safe to do those routes when it's 110 degrees outside. In the summer, I'll often come up to the rim of the canyon and look for moody weather and shoot photos. And so Dan and I are up here doing that for the next 5 days or so. And we found ourselves in some of the rowdiest weather I can remember ever seeing in the canyon last night. I mean, just lightning bolts dropping all around us, 4, 5, 6 different cells circling around, windblown rain just flying across these drainages. I think a lot of this has a particular meaning to me because when I'm looking off the rim of the canyon, I see all of these incredible drainages that Todd and I had previously explored, or Dan on these trips or other friends, right? So I'm not like just looking at this big hole in the ground. I'm looking at Slot Canyon A and Slot Canyon B and Slot Canyon C.
Yeah, you're kind of looking back at your own history in a sense.
Yeah, yeah. And you're doing it from, a vantage point that, people can do with a drone these days, right? But we're doing it from a vantage point thousands of feet above these canyons we had descended before. And they all have this unique meaning, this unique source of beauty, this kind of interest. You see a cell go over a canyon. It's like, oh, what's going to happen in that spot?
You're glad you're not in there.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, so I've really gotten into learning how to take photos and, you know, better photos and kind of get into those remote areas of Grand Canyon while I still can and take some photos of this really iconic place. Every human on the planet's heard of the place. Most people want to visit someday. And it's taken a long, long time for me to realize just why it has that kind of iconic status, because as the light changes in the place, it changes the character of what you're seeing in these really subtle but remarkable ways. And so it's just neat for me even today to, you know, stand on the rim shooting pictures, or, you know, and these aren't the typical places. You know, we like to get into some of the more remote places where we have these viewpoints and we know these viewpoints are good because we've either been there before, or we know that it's overlooking something of interest. Kind of traveling through Grand Canyon has guided and educated me in the composition of good photos. You know, even if you want to stand on the rim, what are you going to see that's interesting, that's in the foreground and the midground and the background? I have found that I spent a remarkable part of my life in this place, and I'm no less enthusiastic about my next trip than I was, you know, 15 years ago.
So speaking of that, what do you have on the horizon from here? Do you know? Do you know what your next phase with the Grand Canyon or elsewhere is going to look like?
You know, I don't know what my next phase is going to look like. Todd and I spent 4 or 5 years doing just raw exploration, right? And in that time, I think we had descended, you know, 110 or 120 canyons. You know, once Todd published Grand Canyoneering, the vivid memories of, you know, the cactus pokes, the hard terrain, the crappy climbing, the rock fall risk, you know, kind of rushed back, and he wasn't interested in doing a lot of new canyons. Occasionally, I still drag him out to do something new. But there was a small group of friends, and we just kept going. Probably been through 60 more canyons since Todd published this book. Some turned out to be just unbelievably remarkable. Some turned out to be just so-so. Glad I, you know, interesting experience once, but probably wouldn't put it on the list to go do again. There are other things to go do. You know, my canyon exploration is slowing down. Still doing canyons, doing more river trips, doing a lot of canyons from river trips, doing more hiking on these long traversing week or 2 week long routes where there's an amazing amount of archaeology. And I've gotten really interested in the last 5 years in kind of the human history part of Grand Canyon, and have found some, you know, remarkable things in Grand Canyon that, you know, talk to that human history. As you spend time doing that, you realize that we weren't the first people to be there messing around. We're not the last people to be there messing around. The routes the Indians were doing were unbelievable. I mean, some of the routes, I spent 4 years trying to put this one route together, just a route to get to a slot. I finally, maybe 2 years ago, pieced it together, and it was absolutely remarkable. It was a slot that could be descended by non-technical means that the Indians had figured out. And there were incredible things on the route that we found, you know, like a log stacked up in a big dihedral with a bunch of rocks built around it that they were using as a ladder. And the more you play around in Grand Canyon, the more you start to stumble across this stuff. And you realize that these people that were part of the ancient history, they knew how to get around that place. And yeah, they're probably some of the slot canyons that were really technical they didn't go into, but we weren't the first to be there. We won't be the last to be there. So I'm interested in, you know, kind of learning more about the human history. I volunteer up at the park, especially in the Western Canyon, where if you were to divide Grand Canyon in half, my biggest passion lies with the western half of the canyon. So I spend time up there with some of the rangers that are involved in protecting the canyon and, you know, helping out with various volunteer things. There was a fellow that disappeared and presumed dead now in the western part of the canyon almost 2 years ago. Maybe it was 2 years ago. I was involved in the initial search when he disappeared, and involved in subsequent searches trying to see if we can track down his body. And there's just a lot of interesting things there. I'm kind of at the point in my life where, yeah, I still want to go explore slots. I still have a list, and there are slots to go do in that list. And I keep ticking them off, 2, 3, maybe 4 new ones a year now. But, you know, it's just a lot of other things about the place that have captured my attention and kind of really motivate me. I feel like it's a good time in my life to be in the position to kind of give back and volunteer and help the park out in certain ways too.
So if someone wanted to see some of the photos that you've started taking, or maybe by the time this comes out, some of these lightning photos that you've got, where could people do that? And then also, where can people go just to keep up with what you're doing in general?
Yeah, you know, I don't have a blog or maintain a website, or I post photos on my Facebook page. I'll put some photos I really like on Instagram, but I'm not huge into just kind of publicizing everything that I do. I feel like Todd did a terrific job in creating, you know, a real quality, in-depth piece of original work that hadn't been done before in how to move about Grand Canyon and see a lot of these slot canyons. There's a reason that his guidebook won the National Outdoor Book Award. I mean, he did a remarkable job in putting that together. I'm not really motivated to publish the new places we found. They'll be there for somebody else to find someday. I think that other people, you know, they should have the right to go poke around their public lands and see remarkable things. I think with publishing canyons and opening up an area that hadn't been known for canyoning before, there's also a responsibility to try to protect and preserve the place. And it's increasingly hard. Todd and I have run around Grand Canyon picking up ropes people left. I've spent a lot of time with the land managers at Grand Canyon National Park and dealing with a variety of issues that canyoneers have caused. There have been some notable rescues. I think in general, the vast majority of canyoneers go into Grand Canyon. They learn something about the place. They're inspired. They have a terrific recreational experience. I feel a sense of accomplishment where those people may not have had a chance to see those places if Todd hadn't published that book and I hadn't spent time helping him with it. But on the other hand, it just takes a few bad actors to really make things tough for the entire community. You know, we have one really terrific canyon that's been closed because people were leaving ropes. I wish that the handful of people in the community that aren't so thoughtful about preserving these places got more thoughtful. People that do canyons to throw up some great photo about, you know, how cool they are, some Instagram thing, look at me here. I'm okay if people want to experience things that way. But from my experience, those are the folks that are least likely to step up and help actually conserve the places where they're recreating, right? If there's graffiti, we ought to get together and remove it. If there are ropes that are left, you know, we ought to fix that. If there's webbing that's used that isn't the right color that might offend other people that come behind you, the park has rules about that. It's kind of a long-winded explanation of, you know, the idea that I hope that the canyoneers that are inspired by seeing Grand Canyon in a different way also are inspired to protect the place, because it is fragile in a lot of ways, and our opportunity to recreate there and see those places is not assured. It's a privilege to be there, it's not a right. So we have a duty to clean up after ourselves, leave the place as good as we found it, or even better. As a result, I'm not likely to put up a website with a whole bunch of new canyons, and I don't think Todd's very excited about publishing anything new. There's just a giant body of canyons that are in his book that people should go see. It's been an exhausting process of keeping our access open to the place and, you know, making sure that people are thoughtful when they go recreate in the park and don't do things that offend other user groups that cause the Park Service to have to take these reactions. You know, the most natural reaction a land manager has is just to close them.
Right. It's always easier to do that than to work with the people. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. So I've thought about, you know, maybe writing a coffee table book with some stories of, there are just so many amazing stories that came about through exploring that place that people might be interested in. Putting some of the photos I really like in that book would be interesting, just to give people a sense of what's in the remote part of the park. I mean, you know, let's face it, what canyoneers do is hard. It involves a learned skill, great deal of effort. You know, the vast majority of society is not going to be able to see these places, but that doesn't mean they shouldn't be able to kind of get a sense of those places through photographs. Mm-hmm. Someday maybe I'll do a book on those things in Grand Canyon that are truly remarkable that people don't get to see or may not get to see. But I'm unlikely to ever do a book that gave the ABC beta on how to get there or even identify where some of these places are. I wouldn't be the least bit offended if people got inspired and went and explored the place and had the same kind of experiences that Todd and I got to have and found some of these places. I'd root them on. I think that'd be terrific. But there's no reason to throw them all out there on the web today for people to overrun.
So you said a word that we mentioned at lunch. You said someday you might. And we even talked at lunch about how when people say someday, that means they're never going to do something. So I would encourage you to say, I am going to put together a coffee table book. And I encourage people listening to this show who would like to see that book to write this podcast and tell me that you want to see that book so I can then pass that email to Rich and we can just nag him and nag him until he actually puts the damn book together.
Yeah, I will do something someday. I mean,
all right, good.
When I did my walk through the canyon, I kept a terse but complete journal of the walk and some of the thoughts and experiences when you're, you know, people go through their entire lives today and they're never disconnected. They're never far from a faucet with running water and a light switch for light and a plug for power. And, you know, if you're a young person today, or even when I grew up, I mean, you know, we grew up in a society that's systematically created infrastructure to make people's lives way easier than they were 200 years ago. And when you take a trip through Grand Canyon for a couple of months, one of the first things you realize is it takes a week or two to kind of realize that you're not connected anymore. There is no light switch. There is no water faucet. You have to do everything yourself. And you're on the clock, because if you don't get to that next food cache in time, you're going to starve. One of the most interesting experiences for me was, for the first time in my life, being disconnected from society. I mean, we did have a satellite text device. I could tell my wife I was okay. She could send me a message. You know, I mean, we weren't like purists, totally disconnected.
Cheater.
Yeah, exactly. But we were in the middle of maybe the largest swath of wilderness left in the lower 48, in this raw, pristine environment, which in most cases has not been impaired by man, disconnected from society. That kind of experience changes you in a way. It causes you to think about things in a different way. And I notice, as I would take my notes each night, it's like, wow, I'm starting to behave in a way that I didn't when I was in society. Not in a bad way. You get into the rhythms of dawn and dusk and night and day, and not the rhythms of get to work, 10 a.m. meeting, report due by 3. I'd like to, you know, at some point be able to write about that through hike experience. You know, these are kind of ideas that are floating around. They don't really all go together well. I think a book that has some great photographs has to stand on its own with maybe a few stories. I think a book talking about the hundreds of stories I have from going through this place is probably a different body of work. So, and by the way, the thing I keep telling myself, you know, the excuse on why, you know, I haven't like framed this up yet, is you're still young enough to move about the backcountry. So you should then be tripping, not reporting.
You can do a second book afterwards with the new stuff, Rich.
Yeah, I know. Anyway, at some point I'll publish maybe even a few projects that give people a sense of just how phenomenal Grand Canyon is as a national park.
So again, everyone, write this show so I can pass it on to Rich so we can make him put together a book. And before we go ahead and finish this now, because we're about done, is there any final thought you want to leave people with before we go?
Maybe the biggest one is, I think it's terrific that people want to go see these natural places that we have in this country. And I would encourage everybody to go do it. But I would also ask people to be thoughtful about how difficult some of these environments are. I mean, 800 people have died in Grand Canyon, 10 die a year, some of them in the backcountry, some in the river. It's not a place where, you know, you open up a book and it's like, oh, I want to go see that. It's a place where you thoughtfully, incrementally go into this environment. You do something easy, you do something a little harder, and you build up your skills. And eventually you do end up being able to go see that incredibly remote but remarkable place. I would ask people not to bring this idea of instant gratification to Grand Canyon, because Grand Canyon doesn't care about your life or your ideas. It works on its own time. You flow with the place. You don't conquer the place. I hope people that are inspired and want to go see Grand Canyon also, as they kind of acquire this experience to go through the place, acquire a deeper sense of how special and remarkable the place is, how fragile the place is. If you're going to visit these places, and I don't care if it's Grand Canyon or any other great place in this country, but step up, get involved, adopt a mindset and an attitude of helping to preserve that place. These great outdoor places are not places where you go to conquer them and leave with, you know, an Instagram photo. These are places that you go to get inspired, to learn about this incredible planet, and to walk away with enough passion for the place that you come back. Not just come back, but you come back and you help out in some way to protect and preserve the place.
So that is everyone's call to action. And Rich has his call to action to get started on his books. And with that, we'll leave you all. Thank you, Rich, for coming out here and braving the city storm so that we can record this under this covered area in this park with yelling kids behind us. So thanks again.
So
So if you are listening to this within a week of its release, you have until Christmas of this year, 2018, to run to our website, gogetoutside.com. Look for this, episode 75 with Rich Rideau, and there you will be able to watch Dan Ransom's film, Last of the Great Unknown, for free. This is a gift to all of you from Dan and Rich for the holiday season, so head to our website now while you can and watch Last of the Great Unknown for free and see some of the hard work that went into exploring all of those many Grand Canyon canyons. And that is not the only reason to go to our website. There you will also find numerous photographs, photographs by Rich himself, and then photographs by Pete McBride and Dan Ransom of Rich in action. And despite the fact that Rich did not mention a single link during the interview, we have many, many links for you to find there on our website in the show notes. Links to Rich's social media, the organizations he's involved with, several magazine articles that he has appeared in, including the one we talked about early in the show from National Geographic, and links to the books and films that he has been involved in. And now would be a great time to contact us here at the show, if for no other reason than to say, yes, I too want Rich Rideau to sit down and put together a book of his stories and photographs. Well, you can do that by sending us an email, go@butcherbirdstudios.com, or pull out whatever device you make phone calls on this day and call us up at 818-925-0106, where you can leave us a message of up to 3 minutes. And if you're looking for something to give us here at the show as a gift for this holiday season, then go to your podcast purveyor of choice, subscribe to this show, rate it, review it, and share it with someone else who'd like to listen to Go Get Outside while sipping their eggnog. This episode of the Go Get Outside podcast was produced, recorded, and edited by me, your host, Jason Milligan, with additional help from Griffin Davis, and as always, brought to you by Butcher Bird Studios. Next time on the show, come back New Year's Day, January 1st, so you can hear us speak to Marinol de Jesus, aka Brown Gal Trekker. She is a lawyer turned nomad who is building an adventure travel business intent on including and aiding local communities. So come back January 1st, Marinol de Jesus. See you then.